Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. Losing your vision as an adult doesn't necessarily mean you have to give up your aspirations or your professional career.
Amy Bauer gradually lost most of her vision as she pursued a PhD in oceanography and continued her career as a research scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. We'll talk with her about her experience leading research cruises, working with colleagues, and towards the end of the program, being attacked by pirates off the coast of Somalia. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Amy Bauer.
When I'm meeting with young students who are blind or visually impaired, I really emphasize the need for them to develop their computer skills because it opens up so many job opportunities as well as just lifelong learning, you know, through the internet, et cetera. You know, if you have those computer skills, you know, the world is really open.
And we've talked about that many times on this show. The technology has improved so much these days that visually impaired people are not at a disadvantage at all if they have computer skills. Computers are just as accessible to the visually impaired as they are to sighted people these days.
And they make it so much easier to obtain information about anything you're looking for. You know, if you can't read what's in a regular print book, well, you can read pretty much anything you want, courtesy of a computer. Let's start by meeting Amy and learning about what physical oceanography entails. Now, actually, our first interaction, if you will, with Amy was when Pete and she were two of four blind scientists featured in an article in Access World over 10 years ago.
My name is Amy Bauer. I'm a physical oceanographer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, where I have been working for about 26 years.
You are visually impaired, I take it, and can you tell us about your vision and how that progressed?
I was normally sighted until I was about 23, 24 years old. Before that, I was definitely noticing problems with my vision adjusting to dark rooms. I specifically remember going to Disney World with my family when I was maybe 18 or something like that. And my whole family knew I had this problem adjusting, so I would go stand inside one of these rides, like Pirates of the Caribbean. I would stand in there for 15 minutes or something before everyone else joined me and before we started the ride so that my eyes would have adjusted to the point where I could actually see better what was going to happen. But at that time, I had no idea that that was an inkling of an underlying vision condition, you know, retinal condition.
So you had not been seeing an ophthalmologist at the time?
No, nothing except normal routine, you know, optometrist. That's right. But when I was 23 or 24, my regular optometrist discovered that I had an abnormal blind spot in my vision. He sent me to an ophthalmologist in Boston, and then I was diagnosed with macular degeneration. But within a few years, I was upgraded to retinitis pigmentosa with macular changes. So for the past now 30 years, just had a gradual decline in my vision. For the first 15 or so years, it was really the macula that was affecting my life the most negatively. You know, I couldn't read text and couldn't recognize faces. And after a while, I couldn't really drive. And I'd say it's really only in the last 15 years or so that the peripheral vision has gotten much worse. So now I use a guide dog for mobility, as well as a white cane at times. And I still have some, I have a little sliver of vision right around the outskirts of the macula. So I do use that vision still for getting around and also for in my work, but I use a lot of adaptive technology also.
Every little bit of vision helps though. You should use everything you have.
I am, yeah, I am, and trying to hold on to it.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
This week's focus topic is the special joys and challenges of being a blind research oceanographer. Can you explain very quickly to anybody who might not know what physical oceanography is?
A physical oceanographer studies the physics of the oceans. In my case, that means that I look at the ocean currents and the forces that push them around, like the wind and other forces. Most people don't think about that when they think of oceanography. They think of the charismatic megafauna, we call it, like whales and dolphins and seals and sea lions and sea turtles. That's what most people have been exposed to as the field of oceanography. But in fact, it's much broader than that and includes chemistry, geology, physics, as well as biology.
How did you first get into that field?
I grew up on the North Shore of Massachusetts in a small coastal community. And ever since I was a child, I've been fascinated by the outdoors and the natural world. I attribute a lot of that to my mother, who is similar in that regard. She took us around a lot when we were kids to different wildlife refuges and science museums, things like that. And then in high school, I had a great physics teacher who was a lot of fun. And I don't know, I thought, oh, physics is kind of cool. And I enjoyed mathematics. And so when I went to college, I also studied physics and math, as well as other subjects. But I wasn't as interested in the particle physics, neutrons and muons and all that. I was much more interested in geophysics, so the physics of the Earth system. And when I was in college, I did a semester program called Sea Semester. It also happens to be here in Woods Hole, which was a semester off campus to just study intensively everything about the oceans, not just oceanography, but history and literature and nautical practices. And it was then that I realized there was a field called physical oceanography where I could combine my training in physics and math with my love of the natural environment and the Earth system. That was it. So I thought, that sounds like something I'm very interested in. I love learning new things. And so I thought I was headed probably for a research career.
Now, what you're doing at the level you're doing it now takes quite a bit more training than just having a bachelor's degree in physics. Can you talk about the next level of training that you had to go through and how that progressed?
Yes. After I got my bachelor's degree at Tufts University, I went to graduate school at the University of Rhode Island at the Graduate School of Oceanography, and I specialized there in physical oceanography and ended up, after an embarrassingly long number of years, with a PhD from the University of Rhode Island. And subsequent to that, I came here to Woods Hole as a postdoctoral scholar, which is sort of like an intern. It's about 2 years long where you start to work more independently as a scientist, but with the advice and mentoring of a senior scientist. And then after that, I stayed on here on the scientific staff.
And now your job is directing some of these projects, writing research grants. What else do you do?
Yes, I do those things as well as analyze the data that we're collecting. I've done a little bit of teaching. I do quite a bit of public outreach, both for the general public on science and oceanography, but also to visually impaired students, mainly at the Perkins School.
So you were talking earlier about how your vision's been decreasing gradually over the last few decades, and that's corresponded with your career growing and your responsibilities evolving. How have the two interacted in terms of what kind of adaptations you've needed to make?
When I first started to have problems reading text, for example, I got a CCTV, and that was great. Both for text and graphics. Graphics are a big part of my work, and so it's been the main challenge through all these years, actually, is having access to graphics. But then as my vision continued to deteriorate, I increased the font size on my computer sort of based on what was available in the operating system, you know. But after a while, that wasn't enough. So then I got Zoom text, screen magnifiers like that. And then reading became very slow, so then I moved up to screen readers. And I now depend heavily, heavily, heavily on screen readers. I also now depend more on sighted assistants than I did at the beginning, because there are just certain tasks, especially around graphics and also research cruises, where it's just more efficient and important for me to work with a sighted guide. So with all those tools, though, I've been able to continue the primary activities related to my profession. You know, I work almost entirely with numbers and graphics and words. You know, so I do a lot of reading and a lot of writing. I do computer programming. So fortunately, you know, screen readers and magnification have allowed me to have access to all of those things pretty easily.
The technology is pretty incredible. And I've always thought that especially jobs that involve computer usage do not particularly put visually impaired people at a disadvantage because the access technologies are so good and so varied these days.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And when I'm meeting with young students who are blind or visually impaired, I really emphasize the need for them to develop their computer skills, because it opens up so many job opportunities, as well as just lifelong learning, you know, through the internet, et cetera. So, you know, if you have those computer skills, you know, the world is really open.
I assume that more recent digital data is easier for you to access than the older variety, where you would get the output off a pen plotter and you'd have to actually look at the plots.
I was just on a research cruise for the month of July, and a lot of the data that's being collected continuously by the ship's instruments is available on an intranet on the ship. And so I can display all that on my computer and increase the magnification to the point where I can see it. So that is a big advantage. Some of the other instruments, it's not so easy to interface with. So it's not universal yet.
So you talked about being on these research cruises. I assume when you're at your office at Woods Hole, you have all your assistive technologies around. You can easily get hold of whatever you want. And on the ship, you probably carry a fair amount of what you need. But there must be additional challenges of being on a ship far away from home in the middle of the ocean someplace.
Yes, very much so. Each cruise that I go on, my vision is that much a little bit worse. And so it's sort of, I need to learn how to cope and compensate all over again. And this last cruise was the most challenging by far from a vision perspective. I bring basically my whole workstation with me, with my large size flat screen monitor and a laptop that's all tricked out, you know, with a screen reader and screen magnification. I have by far the biggest monitor on the desks in the main laboratory of the ship. I've learned, in fact, sometimes when I'm writing a personal email, I'll turn the monitor off because I know everybody standing around can see what I'm writing, you know, and I can do it certainly easily enough without any vision and just with JAWS screen reader. And I don't want the whole lab personnel to be reading my emails.
Right.
The trickiest parts were the just getting around when the platform is moving. You know, there are a lot of handrails, and certainly safety is the prime emphasis on these research cruises. And, you know, there aren't really any conditions that I'm going to put myself in that would be unsafe for me. So I don't do certain things. I don't do deck work where there are instruments swinging around on wires and things like that. So I just don't do that at all.
I would think that would be more of a concern, the safety and mobility, because I would guess you're often on a ship. It may not be a familiar ship, so you haven't had time to get used to the layout.
Yes, that's very much this ship I was on this summer was actually familiar to me from 6 or 7 years ago. But still, it was tough. It's an older ship, too, and there isn't as much universality with, like, for example, where the handrails are going to show up on a stairway or, you know, it's a little bit more haphazard. So it is a little more challenging that way.
You mentioned in the Access World article that sometimes your husband would come with you on the cruises. I gather he's been replaced in that field.
He has been, yes. We adopted a baby girl now 12 years ago. So when we became parents, it wasn't very easy for us both to be away at the same time. So yeah, he's been replaced. I now have several research assistants who will go with me on a cruise and also to professional meetings. I almost always travel with a sighted guide now because it's just too chaotic to try to find meeting rooms quickly, you know, in a huge conference center. So I could do it, you know, especially if I went in advance and used my GPS or something like that. You know, there's all kinds of new and emerging indoor navigation tools and things that you could maybe use with your iPhone, but I haven't had time to do that yet.
It's a lot easier to have some eyeballs. When Nancy and I went to scientific conferences, we always chose conferences that were of mutual interest. So we went together, and that was a lot easier for me.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, and in fact, the research assistants that go with me, they're interested in the topics as well because they work on my projects. So it works out. In fact, I'm just planning this week to go to one in San Francisco, and my primary assistant will also go and present a paper of her own at the same conference. And so it works out. It's mutually beneficial.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably also a good experience for your research assistants to have to describe any of the graphics or any of the information that you need that you might not have been able to pick up yourself as a blind person.
Yes, they get pretty good at it. Some are better than others. And I think it's also taught us both, my primary research assistant and me, about the value of simple graphics. I think people with vision tend to cram too much detail into a graphic. It's almost like having four topic sentences in one paragraph. It's too dense for a viewer to get the gist, one main point. Keeping everything simple, clean, high contrast, you know, so that the main point just jumps right out at you, I think it benefits everybody.
You know, it's funny you should say that, and I'm laughing as you say this, because we go to many scientific presentations where people complain to me about how crowded the slides are, how many different colors, and they can't quickly get the information that they're looking for from these slides.
As you can imagine, Pete and I are both physicists, and pretty much everybody else is a man, and so pretty much everybody else is taller than me, and so much of the time I can't even see the slides very well.
Right.
And I learned a long time ago that if the talk is good, the graphics are unnecessary, and if the talk is bad, the graphics never help.
I agree.
I've just kind of gotten real relaxed about if I can't see the board, I don't really care.
So you mentioned earlier that certainly you're very comfortable with all these access technologies and you use a wide range of them to do your job and be fairly independent. But occasionally you do rely on sighted help. And I think that's great that pragmatically, you know, we're not all islands and we all need help. And I was just wondering how your interactions go with your coworkers, what kinds of responses you've gotten from people through the years.
I've always received very positive responses with people very willing to help describe things that I can't see. I think the biggest barrier in this regard is myself asking for the help. I think especially in science, and especially maybe in the United States or in Western science, there's a culture of valuing independence over interdependence in your scientific work. And I think it therefore took me a long time to be comfortable asking for help when there's this little voice in the back of my head from my scientific upbringing saying, no, Amy, you're supposed to do everything yourself, you know. Even if it's just a physical service, you know, like reading some text for me or something, it's still in that category of getting help, you know, and being helped. So it's taken me a long time, and I wouldn't even say I'm 100% there. I'm a lot further along than I used to be. But I still struggle sometimes with feeling comfortable asking for assistance in my career.
Now, I understand you've started being on some committees to help make sure that these research vessels are a little bit more ADA compliant.
Now, interestingly, I was on a committee about 7 years ago that was tasked with looking at the future research vessels and that were still to be built, designed and built, and to look at them with an eye towards ADA accommodations. Because they're not passenger vessels like ferries, they're not subject to the same regulations. But the national agency that runs the research vessel still wanted to do as much as they could to make the vessels more friendly to people with disabilities. So we had a report about what might work out on research vessels, what would make things easier. And it just so happens this week, here arrives in Woods Hole, the first vessel that has been launched with some of these accommodations purposefully put in. It's not going to be operated by Woods Hole. It's a vessel for the University of Alaska, RV Sikuliak. But I had a chance to have we call it the ADA tour of this vessel. Another visually impaired scientist, a mobility impaired scientist, and a hearing impaired scientist. We all had a tour to inspect the ADA accommodations that they had installed. And so that was pretty exciting.
How did they do?
They did pretty well, yeah. Especially having just come off the older vessel, which doesn't have any of these things, you know, it was very nice. For starters, the lighting was modern and good and plenty of it, you know. They had tactile flooring at the tops and bottoms of each flight of stairs. And also they have a long flight of stairs, you know, many turns. They have a continuous railing that goes all the way around. So you don't have to keep groping around for where does the railing start again. You know, you just keep your hand on it and you can go down four flights. So that was really great. They had Braille labels on all the laboratories and the staterooms, as well as raised letter signage.
That's really nice. So one thing I worry about in places like that is head space. So for example, your cane can tell you when there's stairs or an obstacle coming, but it doesn't catch things at the head level. And sometimes those stairs can get kind of steep and there's something in your way or something sticks out of a wall at head height.
Yes. In fact, in our list of recommendations, we pointed out a few obstacles that were at head height, and they took note of that right away. Like in the main laboratory, there was a fire blanket in a box that was right at head height, you know, and so they're going to move that.
They can hurt.
That was kind of my problem on the older vessel that I was just on, was even doing wall trailing, you know, which I found sometimes was better than my cane because it also provided some stability, you know, for walking when the ship was rolling. There were items, though, tons of things sticking out from the walls. And I was constantly jamming my knuckles and my hands on door jams and fire extinguishers and, you know, junction boxes and everything that was right at sort of hip height.
Have you had any serious mishaps on any of your research cruises?
Fortunately, no. I'm pretty cautious, though, so maybe that's why. I just don't want to be reckless or rushed.
You mentioned that you have a guide dog. Do you bring the dog with you on the cruises?
I haven't yet, and I probably won't. It would be pretty uncomfortable. I know people bring guide dogs on cruise ships, for example. But really, once I do get to know the layout, the routes are pretty repetitive, and for what a dog could tell you, pretty predictable. You know, once I know where the stairs are and I know where the galley is, where we get the food, I think the cane is an easier and better mode for mobility than the dog. And also the dog would be super uncomfortable and probably bored, you know.
Now for this week's final item, Amy's experience with pirates. Have there been any particularly exciting times on a ship when you thought you might have been in danger?
Yeah, we were on a research cruise off the coast of East Africa. This was in 2001. We were studying the water that comes out of the Red Sea because it has a special signature. It's extra salty, basically. And it spreads around in the whole Indian Ocean, and there wasn't much known about how it mixes and spreads. So we were there doing this cruise. And the way a research cruise works is if you're going to work within 200 miles of a country that has an established EEZ, which stands for Exclusive Economic Zone, you have to get permission from their government to do that. Okay. So we were going to be working within 200 miles of Somalia, Yemen, and Djibouti. So we asked for permission from Yemen and got it, and from Djibouti and got it. Somalia at the time, maybe still so, the U.S. doesn't have any diplomatic relations with Somalia. So there was no official government to even ask for this permission. So you could see this as a warning flag, like stay away, or as an opportunity, because the chances were that if they had a government and they weren't that friendly to the U.S. and we asked, we would have been denied. And then we wouldn't have been able to work within 200 miles of their coast. So we worked within 200 miles of their coast anyway, without asking. We went there twice, in fact. And the first time was fine. We didn't have any incidents. I mean, it was a known piracy area, but not like it is today. So we went on a second trip, and that's when we were attacked by pirates, basically. We were about 20 miles offshore of Somalia, but a fishing boat came by, and then some guys jumped in a small boat and came over to us and threatening and showing weapons. And the captain wisely decided we better get out of here. So we pulled up our instrument and started taking off, but they followed us, and they fired weapons at us and grenades and things like that. But the captain was smart, didn't stop, you know, just keep on going. And eventually they just broke off and went back to their fishing boat. And the whole thing was about 45 minutes, maybe something like that. So that was pretty scary.
That must have been terrifying.
Yeah. I was the chief scientist of the cruise, and I felt particularly responsible, even though the safety of the vessel is not my official responsibility. You know, the idea to come to this area was partly mine. And I thought, oh, God, why did we come here? This was such a bad idea. You know, and if anyone had gotten hurt, which fortunately no one was hurt, and the ship wasn't damaged at all. But if anyone had, I don't know, that would have been devastating.
Did you go back for a third trip?
No. Then piracy really took off in the last 10 years or so, you know, and now they definitely don't go anywhere around Somalia.
Good policy.
Yeah, good idea. Yeah. And we've got probably the last best data set ever collected there.
Wow. Well, that's an interesting distinction.
Yeah. Yeah. At least for ocean currents and things like that. Yeah.
And we'll have links to all of the resources you've heard in the show, along with Amy's homepage, and a link to the article in Access World in which Amy and I were featured along with two other scientists, so you can learn more about us. Just go to the show notes for this show at www.eyesonsuccess.net.
That's it for show number 1437. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking with Jerry Chevalier, a computer programmer who was running his own consulting business when he lost his vision. He went on to be instrumental in defining DAISY standards and was the program manager for the Victor Reader Stream book reading device. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and on audioboo.fm at Eyes on Success, or Twitter at _EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.